Today I want to talk about a subject which was discussed last night at a kind of like a party I went to. And at this party there were, this topic was about forgiveness. The topic started off as forgiveness and then it went to criticism. And I was listening to it and it was an interesting kind of an experience because I had so many things to say. I was just filled with comments, but I didn't really have an opportunity or even a desire to put my two cents into the discussion, so I didn't. But there were many interesting points raised about this topic, because it's an interesting topic for people in general to talk about. I mean, after all, one of our main problems in life is that we always find things to criticize, and we kind of make a tension between others and then have to end up forgiving them or begging for forgiveness. Now, I won't get into the details of that conversation last night, but it brought up to my mind the fact that when you speak about criticizing, I think that's the wrong word to use. After all, we all have a discrimination, we have intelligence, we have the capacity to observe and to understand when things are right and when things are wrong. So in that context of our normal observation of reality, our normal observation of things that happen around us, we find that some things are better than other things, some things we agree with, some things we disagree with. Not to have that would be to not be alive. Anyone who has life has intelligence. That implies discrimination. That implies the capacity to take observation and make conclusions from it. And after all, one of the purposes of our discriminatory capacity is to change or transform or adjust the way we relate with the reality around us. That includes also the people within it. And when we comment on this, when we observe what we see and wish to make a transformation of the situation around us, the, I suppose, capacity to criticize would be an important aspect of it. So when we find that there's something wrong with this criticizing, what we are really pinpointing is not the critique, but rather the judgment. Now, judging others in a very negative way, judging people, placing judgment which brings with it a condemnation of some kind or another, this is something which is not very advantageous for the evolved soul. After all, when you judge, you also make favorable judgments, you make unfavorable judgments. So judging in itself is not good or bad. It's just a process we go through. It's the condemnation, in the sense of a condemnation where we transform our relationship or our understanding, or we start to send negative energy towards the other, which brings about problems. Let me give an example to bring it down to earth instead of being very theoretical. Let's say I'm observing a person that I work with, and I observe that they do things in this way. For example, they break things all the time, or they are careless in what they do. So I observe like that. And then let's say in my mind, I make a leap from that observation to come to the point where I say that this person breaks things because they do not care. They do not care because they are selfish and they are terrible as a person. Therefore, I condemn them for that. So we go rapidly from, it doesn't matter how fast we do it, but in the sense of We go from the point of the observation of the events, maybe one or two or ten, to the point of judging them and criticizing them in the sense of condemning them for being careless, foolish, ignorant, stupid, or whatever. Now, it's very important to understand the distinction between observing, seeing something wrong, judging that, and coming to the point of condemnation, and on the other side, observing it and trying to understand it. There's a very big difference between the two. You know, the Indians, the American Indians used to say, never judge a person until you walk 10 miles in their moccasins. When you walk in their shoes, you see things from their point of view. It gives you a different perspective. Let's go back to the example of the breaking, the person who's breaking things or wasting things. What really is their situation? Now, you know, I also drop things. It's one thing that happens with me. I often drop things. It's not because I'm being careless. I'm grabbing for the thing, but my hands sometimes just don't complete the motion. They don't grab the object. Or when they do grab the object, they involuntarily let it go. It's just the nature of my hands that this happens sometimes, especially when I'm in a certain state. So I know what it means to have that problem. Now, don't think that I like dropping things, because when I drop things like glass bottles, I have to pick it all up, and it's glass everywhere. It's a very big disturbance to me. I don't like to do it. It's involuntary. It happens automatically. And when I meet other people who have the same problem, or when somebody else drops something, I say, I know, I have the same problem. I understand why it happens. It can also happen because the glass is slippery, or somebody can become, even if somebody's totally distracted by problems they have at home or problems in their own body or whatever, these things happen. But it's very easy to condemn another person by seeing something that happens to them or seeing something that they do, and immediately jumping to a conclusion, they are foolish, they are careless, they don't care about things, they don't like to do things right, there's something wrong with these people, to condemn them. Therefore, when you understand other people, when you understand what it is that they are going through or what's happening with them, you no longer wish to condemn them for anything that is going on, but you observe what is happening with understanding, and your responses are different. So let's say somebody is criticizing another person. What they're really doing is they've come through the process of observing, of judging, and their criticism is a condemnation. So really what you're saying when you're speaking about criticizing others is when you've come to the platform of condemning them for being what they are or doing what they do. So now let's get to the point of analyzing what it is that motivates people to do things. Now, if you think that people do things irrationally, or that people do things because they are inherently bad, and they purposefully do things which are wrong, you have already condemned those people in your mind, in your consciousness, and basically they have a very hard time to prove themselves to you from that point after you've condemned them. One of the most important things I think I've learned, and I first started thinking about this when I read it in Conversations with God. It was a very, very deep point that everybody does what they think is right at the time they do it. So I started looking back in my own life. I looked back at times when I did things which I condemn myself for. I have this list, my self-condemnation list. You'd be very surprised what was on that list. I'll give you one example in a second. I'll give you an example to show, it's just a very interesting example. It's like practically number one on my self-condemnation list. I think you're going to laugh at it, but I just want to explain it to you. I was in this store, and I was at the cashier. Now, the cashier seemed to have been either a very masculine girl or a very feminine boy. And I could not figure out if the cashier was a boy or a girl. And the cashier made a kind of serious mistake which created a big problem in the registry. And I was trying to say something nice to make the cashier feel that I wasn't disturbed by having to wait while this problem was being sorted out with the manager. And I was trying to say something to the manager like, oh, it wasn't his fault. And then I said, no, her fault. And then I said, oh, anyway. Now, I was trying to be nice. I was trying to be helpful. I was trying to, and yet I couldn't, because I was so bewildered about whether the cashier was a boy or a girl, it came out all wrong. And the cashier was devastated. And I became so devastated thinking that he or she, I still haven't figured it out, was thinking I said that on purpose to cause them difficulty. You cannot imagine the situation. It was so awkward. It was so horrible for that poor person. And for me, I was hysterical when I walked out of that shop. I went out cursing myself. I mean, seriously cursing myself. You don't want to hear what I said about me. I kicked the tree. I was just furious with my stupidity of not trying to be more generic about saying the cashier instead of he or she or whatever. Can you imagine? That's number one on my self-condemnation list. But anyway, just take it from the point of view of an observer of that situation or of the cashier. Let's say they took it just from their point of view. And then they observed my foolishness, and then they judged that I was trying to harm them by criticizing their doubtful gender. And then they condemned me for being a horrible, insensitive person, and then sent all kinds of negative energy at me for that. It would be natural to expect that because, after all, it seemed to have been like that, didn't it? It seemed that I was this horrible, prejudiced person who was trying to stick a knife in their heart. It seemed exactly like that. But in reality, it was totally opposite. It was just simply an impossibly awkward situation. Now, have you ever been in a situation where no matter what you tried to do, you wanted to do the right, it came out wrong? Have you ever been in such a situation? Not exactly similar to the one I just described, but something like that. And were you condemned for it? And did you think about the person who condemned you for it, that they didn't understand? That's a very important thing to remember. Because you can turn that situation around, and each time you're confronted with a situation where you have the potential to condemn somebody else, try to understand reasons why it might be so that they are doing what they're doing. And then keep in mind that you have done in your life all the time things that you thought were right at the time you did it. Now, there are things that at the present moment, when you look back in the past, you say, that was so wrong of me, I did so badly, this was totally incorrect. But that's from the present point of view looking backwards. It's not the way you felt at the time you did it. When you did it, you thought, I'm doing the right thing. Let's analyze this for a second from the point of view of goodness, passion, and ignorance. Now, when I had this difficulty with this cashier, it was my ignorance that created the problem, and it was my goodness that was trying to say something positive and helpful. Now, I thought it was right to try to understand, because otherwise you don't know whether to say he or she, but I wasn't even prepared for the fact that I would have to use the words he or she, and I thought it was right to try to be nice, but because of my ignorance, the power of ignorance caused my expression to become devastating to everybody concerned. Now, let's say I'm doing something totally out of ignorance. I harm somebody out of ignorance. I don't really know what I'm doing. I'm not sure about what I do. I might open the door on somebody's foot or something like that. I thought it was right to open the door. I didn't mean to do what I did. It was totally out of ignorance. So whether I should not be condemned for doing it on out of evilness. It was just a mistake. That's ignorance. And then there's passion, acts of passion. Let's say that somebody has cheated you terribly, let's say in a relationship or something, and then in an act of passion you lash out at them to punish them for what they have done wrong, for hurting you so much. While you are doing it, you are sure this is the right thing to do because they have caused you harm. They need to suffer because of it. Now, one part of you in the back of the mind may be saying, this is a big mistake. But that part does not have as much strength as the part which is saying you have to be gain justice here. You have to cause them harm for what they have done. Now, Kamala Mala is expressing something which, goodness, the server is going berserk. Look at this. Kamala Mala is expressing something which I'm sure many people feel while I'm saying these things, because it's naturally the first thing you think about when you hear that everybody does what they think is right at the time they do it. And that point is, what about people who are doing self-destructive things? Let's say they're drinking themselves to death, or they're taking drugs. Let's go through this piece by piece. What about them? Well, let's remember here, we're not talking about whether what they're doing is right or wrong. We're simply, from any other point of view, we're not making a value judgment. The point here is that they consider it right for them. We're not talking about some moralistic right. We're considering that they think it's right for them. The person who is drinking too much or taking too many drugs or whatever is doing it because they feel they need it. They justify it by saying, I need to do this. I want to do this. They think in themselves that this is something which is necessary for me. So they in their own minds think it's right. Whether we think it's right or not is not the point. They think it's right. Now, when you think something is right that you are doing, this is different than what anyone else thinks, because you are the initiator of the action. You are the one who counts the most when it comes to the choices you make. There have been many There have been many movies and TV shows, especially nowadays, about criminal forensic psychologists. These are people who get into the minds of killers, get into the minds of these people, and understand what makes them tick, and understands why they always justify what they do as right. Some people are thinking that these others deserve to die because they are bad. Others think these people deserve to die because they harmed me somehow or another. They think that I was harmed as a child, therefore everybody should be harmed. Somehow or another, there is some rationale within their motivation which enables them to think that what they are doing is right. Now, let's take a really extreme example. For example, of a sadist. Somebody who just loves to cause pain to others. This is the most extreme example you can think of. They like to cause pain. And they justify it because they say, this is what gives me pleasure. I must have pleasure. It is right for me to have pleasure. Therefore, I am doing what is right. Now, we who stand outside of other persons' environments, outside of other persons' psyches, we look in and we say, this is wrong. And therefore, you should modify your behavior, or we should force you to modify your behavior. But, for example, in the criminal forensic psychologist, their duty, their responsibility is to understand the reasoning, understand the motivation behind the acts that people create. Anyway, Kamala Mullah forced me to get into the extreme example of this. And I don't want to start having to be involved in a social commentary about criminals. What I really wanted to speak about was that in our everyday lives, in our interactions with people, we have to be sensitive to what makes them think what they are doing is right. And it was important to go through that discussion because that's the doubt that comes up in everybody's mind. What about evil people? But what I really mean to say here is there are no evil people. There are just people whose minds are foreign to us. And one has to be very careful to discriminate between the things that people do and the quality of the people who do them. In other words, their human quality. But again, let's forget about criminals for the moment because we're not dealing with criminals here. We're dealing amongst ourselves. So we have to understand what makes other people do what they do. And there's an enormous variety of reasons. If you think about yourself, you have a huge variety of reasons for doing what you do. A huge variety of motives, of feelings, of situations which cause you to do things the way you do. Just consider it within yourself. So when you see something within somebody else which you feel is just so wrong, which would lead you to the process of condemnation, try to understand what is going on within them which is causing them to think that this thing is right. And when you understand deeply through great sensitivity, through great awareness, even through research and observation or discussion, your feeling of condemnation will most likely dissolve away into a feeling of empathy. When you really deeply understand why people do what they do, and they basically do it for the same reason that you do what you do, you have made a great breakthrough that can lead you to the transcendental level. Because you have made a connection with the essential energy of a person, not the external manifestations, not the external ways in which this energy gets distorted into an action which doesn't seem to be appropriate. And if you always consider that everyone does what they think is right at every moment, you will have a totally different way of seeing things. And if you wish to be of service to others, and you see their situation, you understand their situation, you can adapt how you are of service to them accordingly. I don't think you can be of service to others by just criticizing them or condemning them. You are wrong, this is wrong. Because that's immediately a conflict. Rather, you would be much quicker coming to your result by understanding through empathetic hearing, listening, and understanding the other to be able to guide them to a better way of being that is better for them, not necessarily for you. Better for them, and maybe then for you, but most importantly, better for them. Better for me is not necessarily better for you. So when I'm imposing upon you my judgment, that is not necessarily a good thing for you. Now, we understand this point. We've discussed it often. We really think about this point often. I know all of you do. So that I don't mean to push that more, but I'd like to get to the point now of forgiveness, which is a really fascinating topic. Now, we find that when we're having a very great conflict with another person, it's generally there's a lot of criticism going back. There's a lot of things that we take offense for, things which we feel the other has harmed us. And because we are insulted, we want them to beg for forgiveness so that we can forgive them and let go this insult. But if you look on the player, you will see the title of today's lecture is Forgive What? Let's consider all the things we just talked about before. That person did what they thought was right when they created that quote-unquote insult to you. Now, it's possible that you just took it as an insult when it wasn't, like, for example, the cashier that we talked about in the beginning. You could have taken it as an insult because you thought that's the way it was intended, whether or not it was true, or you yourself are not sure about your own identity, and I challenged that identity, conflict or difficulty, and felt that created you to feel insulted. How can you challenge me like this? But often, people insult other people because they feel the other people deserve it. You deserve this insult, you lousy, no good, stinking, rotten. Now, that could be that you really do deserve it because you are a horrible person who did something to them which got them so angry. But that could also be because that person did something to you, who did something to him, which did something to her, which back and forth and back and forth to somewhere ad infinitum in the past lifetimes, you had this conflict between you. So where does it begin? What came first, the chicken or the egg? But let's not go crazy about this. Let's just say they did something terrible to you. All right. Here I am, supposedly an evolved person. How do I deal with it? Well, here's a suggestion. What you can do is try to understand their feelings. Try to understand why they are like that. Now, it could be because of the way you are. It could be because of the chemistry between the two of you. Or it could be they just woke up on the wrong side of bed this morning. It could be that you looked at them in the same way that another person looked at them before, or five people looked at them before, which got them very angry and insulted, and they lashed out at you as the final of the five in the series of insulting looks. There is a million reasons why anybody would do anything, even very much go out of their way to insult you. To understand any of these reasons will give you an insight into the other person. You know, there's a saying, it takes two to tango. You are part of the equation in this tension that has arisen. And therefore, why must you demand the other to be sorry and beg for forgiveness so that you can forgive them to let it go? So, if you think about it, what would it be that you have to forgive if you really understand why people do what they do? If I say, I forgive you for your having such a horrible childhood and having such a lousy mother that you're so frustrated and you're so angry and upset. What sense does that make? I forgive you for being so upset with me all these days because I have been neglecting you and this just caused you to get frustrated and all of a sudden you lashed out at me. I forgive you for that. What sense is that? I forgive you because you actually have a latent cancer developing which is pushing on your nervous system or stressing your bodily energy which makes you unable to perform in a proper way. I forgive you. What sense is that? I forgive you for all your passion of frustrated, unfulfilled desires and the fact that your whole life is a failure and you can't get anything together and therefore you lash out at me. I forgive you for that. When you understand what people go through, why they go through it, why it is they do what they do, what is there to forgive? Understanding is enough. Forgiveness is not required. I've had people tell me, oh, forgive me for this or forgive me for that. If I can remember it at all, which usually I don't, I end up saying, there's nothing to forgive. I mean, sometimes people get upset with me when I say that. They think I don't want to forgive them. Some persons once tried to beg me for their forgiveness, and they said they had committed some aparad, and I said, there's nothing to forgive. And they felt that I was condemning them. It was so wild. They were convinced that this was a plot on my part to make them suffer their aparads eternally. And I was just simply saying, there's nothing to forgive. Now, obviously, it becomes very complex. If you think you need to get forgiveness, then my service would be to you, and I have done this often, is that even though I think there's nothing to forgive, I say, I forgive you. Because they need to hear that. But in reality, there is no forgiveness. There's only understanding. That's what really counts. That resolves the issues, not forgiveness. Or in the higher sense, just not to become offended in the first place like that. Okay, period. I stop that discussion and move on to a point where all that theory we just talked about meets reality. All the theory we just talked about, all of the nice things we just talked about, and the reality of life in a very harsh and very confrontational sense. Let's say somebody consistently, somebody regularly simply does something which you, for whatever reason, can't handle. We have an option here. We don't have to be understanding and empathetic to everybody and therefore constantly place ourselves in the situation where we have to continuously understand, continuously be empathetic and waste our whole days being entangled in somebody else's madness. This is not a case where we have to forgive them for anything or we even have to continually try to understand. At one point, we get to the period, the full stop, where we say, okay, listen, you go your way, I'll go my way. Here's this fence, here's this wall. We don't need to interact anymore. It's not good for me, it's not good for you, I don't like it, you don't like it. So we agree to disagree and we go our own ways. I don't have to hate you, you don't have to hate me, we don't have to feel negative about it, but we just don't do things together. Because you got to be practical too. If you spend your whole day being entangled with understanding all kinds of people, you'll all day be stuck like in this taffy where all over, there's these entangling situations which you're busy being empathetic about, and you're busy being understanding about. You can't live your life like that. You need to have some clear designations and demarcations in life too. And at one point you say, no deal. I don't deal with you anymore. Not in hatred, not in anger, not in a negative way. Just, I can't do it. That's all. Simple. Even though there is only one of us, and I very much want to be of service to all people, there is just a practical consideration that some people I can deal with, some people I can't. And because I have to take care of me too, I have to decide what that line is which tells me I will not deal with you anymore. And when I get to that line, I have to have enough integrity and care for myself to make that statement, make that declaration. I don't want to deal with you anymore because it's not favorable for me. Again, nothing to forgive, nothing to be forgiven for. It's just a statement of what is practical. Now let's take that to a societal level. And let's start to understand how these principles could be relevant or maybe not relevant when dealing with a society of people who are interacting very intimately. Now, there are laws. There are codes. These laws and codes are meant to regulate the way people do things so that it maintains peacefulness and order according to the mentality of those people who have created these laws and codes. Let's go back to the example of the criminal forensic psychologist. The point of the criminal forensic psychologist is to understand the mind of a killer, for example, so that they can figure out his next victim, or they can figure out where that killer might be and capture the killer and put him to trial and put him in jail. Although the criminal psychologist, he's understanding, he or she, is understanding the criminal mind, is understanding what makes them tick, can even empathize with them to a certain extent. That doesn't mean that they agree that the action is right and therefore the person can continue to do it. That's not the point. The delicate balance is maintained when what you think is right contradicts certain basic rights that all beings have. And countries are established on these basic rights. This is what creates a constitution. And usually it starts off with something like, everybody has a basic right to life. Everybody has a basic right to get that what they need to live, to prosper, to seek out happiness, to have freedom to do what they wish to do. Usually these principles appear in every constitution somehow or another. So if you had a really bad childhood and you hated your mother, and therefore you're going around trying to find mother figures that you can rape and kill, we may understand why you do it. That does not mean you're allowed to do it, because your feeling of what you're doing is right has nothing to do with your being allowed to terminate another person's right to life. Therefore, there are codes, therefore there are laws for regulating our interactive relationships on a social level or on a level of simply traffic lights, traffic codes, or legal codes, or civil codes, or codes of contract, or personal contract, marriage codes, whereby we protect those who could be exploited or harmed by others. Therefore, on the highest levels of constitutional law or on the highest levels of regulation and those minds that go into the regulation of a society, they should be steeped or they should be absorbed in the principles which are important to all. And yet the things that can go wrong in another person's mind or in another person's life and try to maximize everybody's pleasurable experience of life. For example, politicians are a very easy target. As soon as you get elected to some office, there's everybody shooting arrows at you. Politicians or anybody who's a public figure who is exerting some kind of authority over others. Yet, they usually do what they think is right at the time they do it, even if it means to steal millions of dollars from the treasury to take care of their family. They think that's the right thing to do. But within those millions that were in the treasury are my tax dollars. I gave to the treasury. Therefore, I have a right to say, you cannot steal from me. So I suppose by now we realize that this is a very complex, a very broad, a very deep subject. And to work together with others, to somehow or another have an empathy for others and optimize our interactions is a very difficult thing which takes a lot of effort. And therefore, yogis and sages go off into the forest because they don't want to have anything to do with this. They say, hey, this is so complex and there's no way to deal with it and you can't avoid it because it's going on every millisecond of the day. I'm going to live in the forest. But if you live in the forest, you have to live alone. Because if you live with another person, it starts all over again. Oh, the fights that brahmanas have about this is right and that is wrong and this is better and that is worse and this is the philosophy and this is not. And then they condemn each other, curse each other with very high sounding words. And why do they curse each other? Because they have the power to do so. And if I have the power to do so, it's right for me to do so. Because I am right. You are wrong, and you must be punished by me because I am better than you, and I will teach you how you are just horrible. And where is the police to police the brahmanas? There are no police to police the brahmanas. They have full freedom to do what they like. Lousy situation. The only thing that counts really, what I'm trying to say here, is that be aware of yourself. Be aware of why you do what you do. Be aware of why you think what you think. And then observe how others could conceivably be similar. Don't condemn just because you have the power to condemn, but rather interact in a way which is at least the best for all concerned. I never said it was easy. I never said this is something that you can easily do. This is a formula you follow. When you follow the formula, you'll be able to figure it all out. Not at all. But rather, it is a process. This is a process, and that's an evolutionary process, to come to understanding. Because what you are doing is you are gradually evolving to the platform of the divine. Because the divine knows everybody's hearts. The supreme knows all hearts and knows why you do what you do and always works for the benefit of all. So the goal is to become godly. Anyway, I have talked for a long time. I guess I did it because, you know, I think this is an important point. Naturally, we cannot give this full justice in this discussion, and I'm sure there are questions. That's okay. Ask them. We'll be glad to answer. The first one here is about something we haven't talked about in a long time, which is about the elementals that people create when they are upset with you. Now, the one asking the question says that they throw negative energy on you with, and this becomes stuck to you as an elemental. And although we can understand that there's no real reason to be upset, but the elemental of the negativity works, and one, until one overcomes it, one will not be able to find peace. So for those of you who were not around when we were discussing elementals in great detail, and as far as I can remember, there is not much discussion in the recorded lectures that you can download. This was discussed many years ago. I'll give a little brief introduction to this topic. An elemental, as we have defined it and used it here, is a energetic thought form. It's a thought form created by energy, projected by energy, which is empowered to work as our energy works. For example, when you really hate somebody or love somebody, you have a tense emotion associated with some thoughts. What you are actually doing is projecting upon them with your thoughts and emotion an energetic thought form which travels to them. And if you are, if there are certain aspects of this elemental which are compatible or which you accept into your energy, it will stick to you. It will attach itself to you. For example, if somebody's throwing an elemental on you, an energetic thought form born of hatred for what you have done, well, because you did it, that elemental comes to you and finds a home because the reason for its existence and your actions or your energies are compatible. So they resonate together and it stays with you. Now, elementals are different than just thoughts. Thoughts are things that fly through our head. They have no real power to them outside of their capacity to disturb us or affect us within. Elementals or energetic thought forms are created with energy. They are created with intention. When a person has a very strong feeling about something, the thought, the purpose of the feeling, the concept of the feeling, and the feeling create an energy which can be projected out from them. In fact, it is projected out from them, even involuntarily. Now, that kind of an energy can also be consciously projected when you are aware of how to do it. It's not that difficult. And it can either be positive or it can be negative. It depends on the emotion involved. For example, positive instances of this would be when you have great thanks for somebody. You just feel so inspired and thankful, and you just offer that loving thanks to that person in your heart, and it just sends an elemental to that person. However, if you mistakenly think they did something good for you when they didn't, that elemental will not have the same effect. It will not stick because it is not resonating with the power which you think it is. Similarly, if you send an elemental of hatred towards somebody for something you think they did to you when they really didn't, it will also not stick. It'll just be like some kind of like disturbance, weird thing. What is this? So the secrets to elementals sticking is there has to be some kind of resonance which is used. And I don't want to get into all of the various details of how you can create artificial resonance, but when you are emotionally creating these elementals, there has to be some kind of reality to it, some kind of reason for its resonance. Now, considering that definition of energetic thought forms, answering this question becomes a little easier. Now, when this energy comes to you, if it is connected, you either have the choice of removing it. Let's say you have that capacity that you can remove it or somebody else can remove it. Or you can deal with it in a kind of a negotiation if it's negative. After all, if love elementals come to you or love thought forms come to you or thankfulness thought forms come to you or gratefulness thought forms come to you, you're not going to worry about removing it. You're not going to worry about dealing with it. So when you're dealing with a negative thing, you either get rid of it or you deal with it. Now, getting rid of it is difficult. It requires a lot of power, or it requires having a friend who's got that power. And dealing with it is difficult because you're going to have to go through that entire process of dealing with a situation which got so out of hand that this great emotion was created, negative emotion was created within another person, which caused this thought form to be sent to you. Now, sometimes it is important to go through the process of dealing with it, because sometimes it is very possible that the reason for the creation of this thought form was some deficiency or defect within yourself. And simply resisting it, simply pushing it away, is going to create its persistence. What you resist persists. When you resist the change that this thought form is suggesting, or you even try to push it away, even if you succeed, it will return, because it's something you have to deal with to transform that within you that needs transformation. So all in all, it is very important that we be aware of, sensitive to, the purport of these energetic thought forms that we are having to deal with. And rather than struggling with them, to enter into a negotiation with them. Now, when an elemental is associated with a personality, that personality's continuous feeling about that situation feeds it. So it is not so easy to get rid of. But if you deal with the source of the energetic thought form in that negotiating process, the thought form follows automatically. In other words, it's an invitation to a negotiation. I feel bad about this. I'm sending that to you. Deal with it. I want some satisfaction here. That's what the thought form is saying. And one of the interesting things about the nature of this world we live in is that sometimes we have no choice. We have to negotiate. Now, this question is, how do you quickly deal with it? Well, I just finished saying that you don't quickly deal with it. You have to negotiate with it. But let's, for the sake of argument, and this may or may not be true in any particular case, let's, for the sake of argument, say you are dealing with an energetic thought forms that are thrown upon you which are not based in reality. In other words, they're not right. And even though it's not sticking to you, it's hovering around you and giving you a hard time on the mental platform. Now, how do you deal with that? Well, at that point, we can start talking quantitatively in terms of the time required to remove it. If you remember, we some weeks ago had this session where we were practicing to scoop up negative energy and then burn it away. And you can, of course, try to do that with elementals, to scoop up these negative thought forms, scoop up all this energy by tuning yourself to that particular vibration of these negative thought forms. And scooping them up into some kind of a vessel or a bag or something that holds them, and just burning them up with fire, violet flame or fire. In pranotherapy theory, those kind of thought forms are burned up with a kind of electric violet, whitish violet light. So that's how you quickly do it. You can even quickly do it, if you have the capacity, even when it's sticking to you, when, in other words, there's a reason for it being there. And possibly, probably likely, another form of it will return, because it is based upon or based in something you need to deal with through negotiation. Now, I got an interesting question as I was talking here. I mean, the same person bops out this other question. Can one see elementals, and how do they look? Well, obviously, if I have to tell you how they look, you can't see them. And there's no reason to worry about how they look if you can't see them. Because they don't come in a can labeled elemental. They come in all different forms according to the creator, according to the emotion, according to the time, and according to the way in which they find resonance within you. But you can feel them, and you can feel their intention. That's how you see them. You can tune yourself to them and then ask, why are you here? What do you want? What is the point? And just feel that connection. Once you have made that connection by inviting it to communicate with you, just feel what it is. And then in that sensitivity, you'll understand much about its creation, its creator, and the negotiation required. Now, accordingly, the second question, which is coming from St. Petersburg, this is from Moscow, this one is from St. Petersburg, and this person is saying that they react to people not according to what they say, but how they say it. They read the energy of what is being said, and when it is negative, they find themselves pushing out negativity towards them. And they don't like that they do this. They want to know how to deal with it. Now, this is an involuntary reaction. And many of us have that. That we deal with negativity. That when it's pushed upon us, we deal with it in a, I don't want to say reciprocating fashion. I would like to say a mirroring fashion. We mirror the negativity back. Now, sometimes mirroring back or reflecting back the negativity is a useful way to modify the behavior of the negative person, sometimes. But that only works when the person who is seeing the reflection is capable of being aware of the fact that it is a reflection. Because if they think this is actually coming from you, this is not just a reflection, and it may be right, they will increase the negative energy towards you because it then becomes an escalating battle. Whereas somebody who's sensitive to the fact that it's a reflection will learn from that. They will learn. They will see, oh, this is what my energy is producing. This is what my energy is. And they will change. That's a rare person nowadays. Now, again, like I said in the beginning, it's natural that when somebody pushes negativity upon you to want to reflect it. But I spoke about reciprocation as being different than reflection. Now, an inappropriate reciprocation would be a reciprocation whereby it would be against your own self-interests. In other words, reflecting to a person who was incapable of understanding the import of the reflection. Whereas an appropriate reciprocation would be one which would be favorable to you, which would imply it would also be favorable to the person who is the source of the negativity. Now, an appropriate reciprocation can have many forms depending on the situation, but I like what Kalavati has suggested. She said, use humor. Use your sense of humor to make people laugh about the way they are expressing this negativity. Actually, humor is fabulous. It's a fabulous way to dissolve that negativity, to simply diffuse a potentially dangerous situation. But that is not always true, because sometimes a person gets even angrier when they think you're trying to make a joke about their very serious feelings. So it can also be a dangerous tactic too. I would recommend, if it's possible, to diffuse the negativity by accepting it. Accepting it. Just accept it. Yes. Yes, you're right. Right? Or, yes, I understand. And somehow make a connection that their feeling has value. You value their feeling. You appreciate the way they feel. That's the technique of the martial art, where you use the energy of the person to diffuse their own energy, where you let them, when they attack you, just to fly by. You take that energy, and instead of opposing it, which creates friction, right? When you oppose, it creates friction. You flow with it so that it doesn't hit the target. It doesn't have the negative effect. Now, that's good for both, because when the conflict comes like this, it hits on your knuckles, and on their knuckles, it hurts both of you. Whereas if you let it flow, it hurts neither of you. That's a very important consideration. After you do that, then humor is very powerful. It'll help dissolve the situation much faster. If you can see humor in a situation, use it. It's great, because the reality of these situations usually is some absurd thing. Or just make fun of yourself, how foolish you have been. There are many tools at your disposal. But really, what the basic principle is, to not fight fire with fire, because that only works in very specific situations when there is no other way to fight fire. Speaking as a former fireman who's graduated from fire school, the first way you fight with a fire is to simultaneously flood it with either water or powder or whatever the appropriate substance is, and to remove the source of the fire as quickly as possible. But sometimes the fire is so big, like in a forest, it's just so big that you can't deal with it. It's beyond your human capacity to deal with. So you create a backfire, which is under your control, which burns towards the big fire, and when the big fire and the backfire meet, they burn out because there's no more fuel to the fire. So when negativity is so out of control, when somebody's just hysterically out of control, sometimes you have to fight with fire with fire. So it's not, there are no set rules. You have to know what tool to use when it's appropriate. For example, I'll give you an example. People may think that the reason the British left India was because of Gandhi, Gandhi's nonviolence, and therefore nonviolence is the key in all political situations to achieve your end. But there are other factors involved that they're maybe not aware of. For example, there was a world war. In that world war, Britain's powers were greatly reduced. Their economy was greatly damaged. It wasn't just India. Their whole empire fell apart after that. And as I heard from the relatives of Subhas Chandra Bose, who was this great fighter for freedom with India, he used military force whenever the Indians were captured by Germans who were in the British army. The Germans just handed them over to Subhas Chandra Bose, who used them in the military effort against the British in India. But it's more romantic to think about the non-violent, non-cooperation movement. Gandhi became such a spiritual figure in the minds of many people. It's more romantic to think that way. But in the practical reality of situations, you have to have a multiplicity of options to deal with any situation, and actually firing fire with fire has to be one of them. Otherwise, you can find yourself in big trouble in life. But as a general rule, I recommend personally always dealing with situations before they get out of hand. To just simply say the situation doesn't exist, it's going to go away, is not a very wise thing. Better to deal with it as soon as one can. Just like a little fire in the forest can become very big if you don't deal with it. As Chanakya Pandit said, you have to deal with fire, debt, and disease, because if you don't, they go out of control. But you have to deal with these things appropriately. And appropriate dealing means to understand the validity of what's coming at you and appropriately respond, take responsibility for your part of the creation of that negativity and deal with it appropriately for the benefit of both. Now, here's another question which I've heard before. I'm sure it's been asked before and answered before, but I'm going to answer it again anyway because it's kind of associated with this. A person doesn't want to associate with a close friend because of the close friend's behavior, which created a great hurt in the heart. And then you miss that close friend, but you stick to the decision because you're just not ready to accept this unacceptable behavior. How do you deal with it? How do you deal with the pain? How do you release this tension, this emotion inside? Well, I don't have an answer to that question. And the reason I don't have an answer to that question is because I can't do it either. I've got the same exact problem. And it's just sometimes chemicals. It's just chemicals. It's just something you can't do anything about. You cannot fix everything. Sometimes you just have to accept it. Sometimes you just have to swallow the bitter pill. And usually the difficulty is like, I love you, but I can't stand being with you. I love you, but I don't want to talk to you, because as soon as I talk to you, there's all this trouble. As soon as I deal with you, there's all this trouble. I love you, but go away. That's just part of life. I have not figured a way out of that. I'm sorry. I can't answer that question. I mean, you can love somebody, you can respect them, you can wish that you had some way to deal with them, but sometimes you just have to admit it doesn't work. How do you deal with the pain? I don't know. Time. After a while, it doesn't hurt so much. After a while, you learn to just accept it. Because you can't do anything about it anyway. You just have to accept it. I mean, I have had situations with people. I loved them very much. I respected them very much. I even tried in many ways to make an interactive relationship. But the chemicals of the relationship made it impossible for that relationship to continue. It's like when you got fire and ice. I mean, they might love each other. The ice may say, hey, I like fire to warm me up. And the fire may say, hey, I need like ice to cool me off. But they can't get together because they both get ruined. So you appreciate from a distance. And that is my lousy answer to that question. I'm sorry. I can't give you better than that. So I guess sense of humor entered into that one. Okay, here's an interesting question. It's interesting not because of the question itself, but because of what I can do with the answer. Now, I know that in the Vedic literature, in the scripture, the Shastra of the Hindu culture, Paramatma, Supersoul, the Lord in the heart, is a very significant feature. And it is a very delicate subject when dealing with many different kinds of people, many different kinds of cultures and intellectual concepts and also energetic concepts. So let's put aside for a second belief. In other words, it was stated somewhere. You believe it to be true. Let's just put that aside for a second. I know that's a rather delicate issue. But let's just do it for the sake of argument. And let's think of it from a very philosophical point of view of the omniscient, omnipresent God, who's everywhere, who's all-pervading in consciousness, who is the best well-wisher of every person, every living being. Now, when we speak of heart, we really speak of the spirit, the essence, the life force energy of consciousness that is pervading throughout our life, which gives the energy by which all things take place within our existence. All our consciousness is interacting with the world, with the universe, within which we feel our identity, our presence, our existence. And that spirit is naturally connected with God. After all, the consciousness, the spiritual consciousness, is by nature connected with the Supreme and all spirit. It's a natural connection. That energy is flowing. The communication, the love is just flowing. The sharing of energy is flowing. And if the seat of my consciousness, if the source of my consciousness is that spiritual consciousness, that spiritual energy which is me, that essence, then naturally the connection with the Supreme would be there as well, in that seat of my consciousness. I'm using a figure of speech. From that point of view, by definition, God is in your heart. However, God is also everywhere else. But we're specifically speaking about this issue of God in the heart. God is absolutely connected with us through the heart. So therefore, there's the connection, there's the location. Now, let's talk about God in the heart as the temple of the heart. The temple of the heart. The seat of our internal worship, practice, bhajan, as you will. Some speak about it as the temple of the mind. I don't care how you want to relate it. We're talking about the spiritual energy connecting with the object of one's love, the Supreme, the object of one's love. Now, I may organize, I may build, I may decorate, I may perceive my temple and my deity within according to my own spiritual feelings, my own spiritual understanding. And absolutely, the Supreme will reciprocate with that. Just as we learn to reciprocate and appreciate others in their difficulties by understanding what they're going through, certainly the Supreme can do that much easier and much more powerfully with us. So therefore, that reciprocation, when we call our particular deity, deity meaning the way we connect with the Supreme, within our temple, the Supreme will relate with that instantly. Therefore, in almost, I mean, I'm not an expert in all theologies of the world. I'm not an expert practically in any theology of the world, but it seems to me that all theologies that I have any familiarity with accept a similar understanding of the connection of God, if you will, or the deity, if you will, within the temple of the heart. They may call it the church of the heart. They may call it the chapel of the heart. They may call it the sacred place in the heart. But that concept is there amongst all religious people all over the world because it's natural. And naturally, your deity may take whatever form you harmonize with, you resonate with, that you feel very comfortable with. That is why, even though the Paramatma in the Vedic conception was so emphasized, later on, the form of Gauranga would appear in the heart, replacing Paramatma, as it were. Or the forms of Radha and Krishna would appear in the heart, replacing Paramatma. I know that's a very strong word, but that is how it is dealt with within those more sophisticated forms of the Eastern culture. I have found in my observation of how the Eastern traditions affect me personally on a very practical, experiential level, that there is always a reason for it. There's always a way in which these explanations can be universalized in almost all experiences for the sake of anybody. And therefore, elitism is not only not required, but it is in almost all cases an obstacle to one's own spiritual growth, and certainly an obstacle to the growth of others who choose to be around you or who are forced to be around you and have to hear about your elitist formulation of your philosophy. And the last question I have here, boys, we're really going on today. It's quite exciting in one sense. Moscow is asking about this person had some years ago to deal with a lot of insults that could not be overcome. But the secret to overcoming was to just love the self, because it helps a lot to forget and forgive everything. And I would agree with that 100%, except that, as I stated, or tried to state, or tried to explain, if it was correct, that forgiveness, forgive what? I would say in the case of loving the self, to forget and forgive, what you're really doing is forgiving yourself for being so upset in the first place. Maybe that wasn't the response expected, but that's what I came up with.